Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Etablissement, dem kleinen Theater-Podcast für die Dame, die sich immer noch fragt, warum gibt es Krebs, warum gibt es AIDS und warum hat dieses Oberteil einen Anteil von 3% Elastan? Und was ist Elastan überhaupt? Heute mit dem zweiten Teil des Rückblicks auf den USA-Trip des Etablissements. Letztes Mal ging es ja eher um so theoretische Fragen oder da habe ich Clips rausgesucht, die quasi eher so diese theoretische oder vielleicht auch historische Dimension der Trennung von ernster und unterhaltender Kunst beleuchtet. Und dieses Mal sollte es ein bisschen mehr um die Stories und um die Persönlichkeiten gehen, denn wie beim letzten Mal ja vielleicht auch schon gesagt und auch in den Episoden ist das ja, glaube ich, immer mal wieder herausgekommen, ist mir aufgefallen, dass in den USA so das Subjektive und das ganz Persönliche in der Bühnenkunst eine ziemlich große Rolle spielt. Also Bühnenkunst entsteht da ja auch auf eine ganz andere Art und Weise, eben nicht so subventioniert, nicht über so eine Art Fördersystem, wie wir das hier haben oder wie zum Beispiel in der freien, experimentelleren Szene hier in Berlin über Anträge, die man schreiben muss. Und häufig ist die Motivation, dort ein Stück zu machen, einfach ein ganz ureigenes Interesse an einem Thema, an einer Vorliebe, an einer Form von Musik, an irgendetwas, was in der Kindheit passiert ist, wie auch immer. Und daraus entwickeln Leute Stücke, Projekte, Ideen, die dann irgendwann auf der Bühne landen. Das ist natürlich eine ganz andere Herangehensweise, als wenn man hier in Deutschland lange Anträge schreibt, einen ganzen konzeptuellen Über- und Unterbau hat, bevor man überhaupt mit dem Stück beginnt. Das schlägt sich auch so ein bisschen in dem Sprechen über diese Kunst nieder. Also ich fand die Treffen mit den Leuten, mit den Theatermachenden in Amerika, egal auf was für eine Art von Bühne sie standen, immer als sehr gelöst, sehr persönlich, von einer großen Liebe so für das Bühnengenre geprägt. Und das ist man quasi hier aus Gesprächen in Deutschland gar nicht so richtig gewöhnt. Da geht es immer sehr stark um ein Thema, das bearbeitet werden soll. Etwas Politisches, etwas Gesellschaftliches, etwas Kritisches. Das klingt alles immer sehr trocken. Und das Unterhaltsame muss sich immer auf irgendeine Art so daraus dann erwachsen. Aber es ist nie der Zweck, es darf nie der Zweck sein. Also es wirkt fast so ein bisschen so, als wäre das quasi hier so eine Art Ausschlusskriterium. Also sobald ich sage, mein Ziel ist einfach, den Leuten eine gute Zeit zu bereiten, egal was dann politisch da immer noch mit rüberkommt, fliegt man aus so einem Antragssystem eigentlich erstmal raus, weil es ist nicht relevant, es ist nicht spannend, es ist nicht zeitaktuell, so etwas zu behaupten. Und in Amerika, dadurch, dass sie eben dieses System nicht haben, was auch wieder schwierig ist, einerseits, andererseits, wie viele Dinge im Leben, gibt es diesen Effekt nicht, sondern es wird ganz aus diesem persönlichen geschöpft. Und ich habe das Gefühl, das resultiert häufig in so total zugänglichem, sehr unterhaltsamen Theater, das einem auch Dinge zeigt, die einem vielleicht erstmal fremd sind oder die radikal sind, eben weil sie so subjektiv aus der Perspektive einer Person erzählt sind. Anstatt dass man, wie häufig hier in Deutschland, vielleicht sozusagen erst das große Ganze im Blick hat und dann sagt, und dann will ich es aber auch noch zugänglich gestalten. Das heißt, das Thema ist schon total komplex und dann muss ich überlegen, wie kriege ich die Leute dahin. Umgekehrt in Amerika, die Grundvoraussetzung ist, ich kriege die Leute hier hin und alles andere ergibt sich dann daraus. Auf eine Art liegt darin ja auch was Politisches, also zu sagen, ich will möglichst viele Leute ansprechen. Man könnte natürlich auch wiederum vorwerfen, das ist so der kleinste gemeinsame Nenner, der dann bedient wird. Das ist wiederum die andere Seite des Ganzen. Aber trotzdem hat das Ganze dadurch so eine Zugänglichkeit, die ich einfach sehr spannend fand. Und auch in den Gesprächen fand ich die Leute immer so sehr einfach, sehr direkt, sehr begeistert und auch begeisternd über ihre Arbeit sprechend. Und da könnten sich auch so Förderinstrumente hier in Deutschland fast so ein bisschen vielleicht auch so ein Beispiel dran nehmen oder vielleicht sich mehr dran orientieren. Ich weiß gar nicht, wie man das schaffen könnte, dieses wahnsinnig theoretisch und wahnsinnig Verkopfte da so ein bisschen rauszukriegen und einfach Leuten zu vertrauen, die sagen, ich liebe 70er-Jahre-Operetten aus der DDR und mache daraus ein Stück. Und das ist es erstmal. Und dann vertraut man und guckt, sagt, hier hast du deine 100.000 Euro, mach dieses Operettenprojekt. Anstatt dass die Person Marx und Engels und Überbau und Unterbau und das will ich und so soll's aussehen und so soll's aussehen, auf eine Art habe ich manchmal das Gefühl, das killt so ein bisschen die Kreativität und man wird als Künstler, Künstlerin da zu so einem, fast so ein bisschen zu Erfüllungsgehilfen seines eigenen Konzepts, das man vorher schreiben muss, um überhaupt in die Realisation seines Stücks zu kommen. Wie auch immer, viel dahergelabert. Das war so ein Punkt, den ich auch aus dieser Amerika-Reise so für mich rausgezogen habe, den ich sehr spannend fand und wo ich dachte, nehme das so zum Anlass, jetzt ein paar so Gesprächsmomente, Werdegänge zu präsentieren von amerikanischen KünstlerInnen, die sich vielleicht auch so außerhalb dessen bewegen, was man so ernsthafte Kunst in Deutschland nennen würde. Und genau, da hören wir jetzt rein. Und without further ado wünsche ich viel Vergnügen mit Carla Henkel und Max Pittegoff vom New Theater Los Angeles, Paige Person, Kain Karias und seiner Puppe El Triste, der Comedian Lizzie Cooperman und der New Yorker Drag-Legende Charles Bush. Los geht's.
So I started doing stand-up because I had wanted to, but I felt like it was a U-turn in my life. Mm-hmm. I had called once about a comedy class and I didn't like how the guy sounded over the phone, so I just didn't take it. And I thought I should just sign up for a class. And
how old were you then?
24 or something. Oh, no, older. 29 maybe.
You already did the poetry and the art stuff.
Yes, I was already.
Then you said, I take a comedy class.
Yes, okay. So I took this class. It was very interesting. The first exercise was it was in a Best Western hotel room, like in kind of a smaller town in Minnesota. It was really an interesting group of people, you know?
Imagine.
I feel like I'm saying like Best Western, and in my mind, I'm like, don't expect Johan to know what a Best Western is.
Of course I know.
But you know Best Western,
yes,
okay.
Yes, of course. And I can imagine like the room you've been in, like a conference room or something.
Yeah, it was like a little bar. It was a bar,
okay.
Yeah, we met in the bar.
Okay.
And we would go up one, but it was like a carpeted, you know, like dark green, like a little pub.
Yeah.
Give you some lingo you understand. It was a beer garden.
Prost.
Exactly. And so we went up one by one and we were supposed to tell each other what we saw when we looked at each other. So not say anything. You would just go stand there and people would go, I think Johan's a dentist or whatever. Mine, they were very on the fence about
what you are,
what I was, I noticed. Whereas everyone else had something very specific. Some people thought I was a librarian. Some thought I worked in a nightclub. You know, they all had different ideas. So I didn't get a lot out of that exercise, but I loved watching it because it gave a lot of people, like, it's very kind of comedy 101 to start with how you look. Say, like, The classic joke is like, I know what you're thinking. And then you make a joke about your appearance. So that's kind of where I think he was trying to get us started with some stuff that we could say off the bat when we got on stage. But it made me think this feels like has so much to do with identity. And I thought that was really interesting and how your act changes as you change. So I started doing stand-up, but I started doing it in a really way more conventional way
than you do it now.
Yeah.
Okay.
I learned how to write jokes. I had an act and I started very quickly after taking that class, probably a month or two after featuring or going on the road and opening for people in small towns. There were a couple.
So it was the classic like bar stool, water bottle.
Yes.
Standing.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, my material was about like my boyfriend and guys or I'm not saying it was this. I mean, it was where I was, you know, being broke and all this stuff. So that was kind of where I started. And I did that for many, many years. And I actually had more commercial success with that. Okay. I got to do a late night set. You know, I got to like tour more. I felt like it was just more accessible. And I had kind of a breakdown because I got called in to be on this TV show on MTV where they, you know, those shows that they play a clip and then the person responds like and makes a joke about the clip. Do they have that?
Be like a talking head, like
it was a talking head,
like old videos or something.
Yes, like
comment on it.
Exactly, like someone wipes out on a skateboard and you say something funny about it. Yeah. You know, so they brought me in for one of those, and this was a huge turning point where I thought this just doesn't feel like me. Like I just felt like I wasn't using my. I don't want to say like my great potential, but it just felt like I was faking it, or like I was pulling something off. Mm-hmm. Like I felt like I liked my jokes, but I couldn't figure out where I was in it. You know, I couldn't figure out. And I also felt like I was writing jokes that were less just set at punchline and more like worlds. And I also had a manager at the time who I did this set that I loved with jokes that I still really like. And I brought it in to her and she paused it and was like, this is not stand up. And I was shocked because I was going to submit it for another late night appearance. And she basically was saying like, I want the old you. Mm-hmm. I want the girl.
And the boyfriend stories.
Not the woman. No. We want the old Britney.
Women's stories matter.
Exactly. Women's stories matter. But I did feel like she wanted me to be, which is fine. She signed me as my to represent
as that old self.
Yeah. Then that material and that persona. And I started to grow out of it. And then I did this talking head thing. And you have to bring in jokes. So they'll show you a clip. The clips beforehand, and then you at home write jokes, and then you come in and they tape you doing the jokes.
Yeah.
So I did all my jokes, and then at the end they said, can you just do one more and just go, uh-oh, SpaghettiO, after someone like fell on a skateboard, or maybe it was like Taste the Rainbow. It was something that was in a commercial, like a line from a commercial. And I was like, you know, in my mind thinking, I don't really think that's funny, but I'll say it because I was also wanting to please them, and I wanted them to obviously ask me back. So then the show aired, and that was the one line they used, was me being like, uh-oh, SpaghettiO. And I just thought, how did I end up here? How am I? It just felt so far away from where I'd start my creative core. I don't even mean where I've started, but just who I am. And I had a show, I had some show that week, and I remember sitting in my car and thinking, I can't do this the way I'm doing it. And I went to a music store and I bought a piano and I brought it to my show. And the first time I used it, I wasn't using it in the same way I am now. I just was using pre-recorded songs. Like I actually, speaking of Britney Spears, I told a story about meeting Britney Spears, and I told it to like some public domain song that just played on my keyboard. And afterward, I thought, oh my God, I feel like I cracked something open for myself.
So did you really meet Britney Spears?
Yes.
Okay.
I worked. Are you a fan?
Yeah, of course. Who's not?
I mean, that's so funny. Yeah, I worked in a store on Melrose Avenue in West Hollywood called Diane von Furstenberg. Are you familiar with DVF?
Yeah.
And so I worked in her store when I first lived here, and we got a call and they said, draw the curtains, kick everyone out, a celebrity's coming in. So we had to tell everybody, get out of the store, I'm so sorry. And I was helping this woman who looked like she was going to buy a ton of stuff. And I said, I'm so sorry, but I have to put the stuff on hold. She goes, I won't say anything to the celebrity. I'll mind my own business. My boss said, it's fine. Let Andrea or whatever her name is shop. We close the store. The celebrity comes in. And this is right after Britney's nervous breakdown, by the way. Maybe a month after or something like that. And I can see my woman staring, peeking her head out of the curtain, staring at Britney Spears. And I'm like, what are you doing? I go, okay, let's go back. I was still trying to be polite, but then Britney comes to the register. Finally, she's done shopping. She pays. My woman comes out and she goes, I just wanted to tell you, you look very well. I was so mad. And then she went back in the room and I go, you said you wouldn't say anything. She goes, I just wanted to say something nice to her. And in my mind, I thought, because you want to go back to your country club and tell your friends. And I met Britney Spears. I gave her my
life advice.
Yeah, my life advice. Yeah. Straight from the desk of Andrea. I told, you know.
Okay, so that's a story you used.
It was one, yes. I can't remember exactly. I talked about that job. And then I just started bringing it to shows and people were not on board because they knew me a certain way. And I think they saw it as like a hook or a crutch or something. And I just had to kind of ignore them. You know, they would be like, oh, you're bringing you got your keyboard again, you know.
And it's interesting. You have this interesting way of playing the keyboard. It's like almost like you are hating the keyboard or you're just hitting on the keyboard or something. I don't know.
Did you say hating?
Hate it. Yes.
Like I hate the keyboard.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
You're not talking to the audience and with the other hand, just like, but
yeah,
it sounds so amazing. So it's perfect.
But it's a challenging thing for me to market. Like if I'm doing a headlining show or something, I'm coming to town. How to explain to people, like, oh, you see a picture of a woman with a piano, you're going to make some assumptions.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe a little bit, like, your style or what you are doing on stage? Is it even possible? But you said, like, it's hard for you to describe, even for a flyer or something.
You know what's so funny? I was just talking to my friend about this because you have to write a description of your... I have an album. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I had to write a description of it. And my friends and I wrote a description that was so, we tried to put every cliche in there possible to make it funny. Like just loaded it up with like, she'll take you through the kitchen of intimacy to the smolding fireplace of satire. Like, but I can't see outside of myself.
Okay.
I don't see myself. And actually, a lot of times when I do, I don't. It's hard for me to watch. It's hard for me to see because I'm coming from the point of view of I just need to do this.
Mm-hmm. You don't want to think about it.
So right. Basically. I don't want to think about it. Like, I want to. I have. If you saw my notes, they're crazy. It's a mess. I try to make order of it the best I can and try to communicate it. And then
if you are going out for one of those sets, you don't know exactly what you are going to
right.
do.
Yeah.
Oh, you know.
I could show you like a picture or something of one of my set lists.
Oh yes, please.
Keep this part as I'm rummaging. Yeah. I loved the part when she went through her bag.
Amazing.
Das war Lizzie Cooperman, die Stand-Up-Comedy macht in Los Angeles und das auch schon ziemlich lang. Sie hat angefangen als Performance Artist, das kann man alles in der Episode mit ihr auch nachhören und macht inzwischen ziemlich schräge Comedy. Sie schleppt dabei immer ein Keyboard mit auf die Bühne, wir sprechen ja auch so ein bisschen darüber und hämmert wie wild auf dieses Keyboard ein. Parallel dazu erzählt sie eben ihre Geschichten und verwandelt ihren Alltag damit in so eine Art völlig absurder Comedy-Horrorshow. Ich fand das sehr, sehr toll. Und war sehr froh, dass Lissy mich getroffen hat und mir so viel erzählt hat. Als nächstes ein Einblick in eine ganz andere Bühnenwelt, ein ganz anderes Bühnengenre, das Puppenspiel. Und zwar habe ich im MacArthur Park in L.A. Kein Carias getroffen. Er hat auch seine Puppe El Triste dabei. Kein ist als Kind mit seinen Eltern aus Tijuana, also aus Mexiko, rüber nach Los Angeles gekommen. Und hat ziemlich früh schon zu Schulzeiten angefangen, im Bob Baker Marionettentheater zu arbeiten in L.A. Erstmal als Art Bühnentechniker und eben später als Puppenspieler. Dann irgendwann dort aufgehört und hat Bob Baker sehr viel zu verdanken und hat eine Puppe entwickelt, auch um so ein bisschen Werbung zu machen für das Bob Baker Marionettentheater. Diese Puppe, El Triste, ist inzwischen zu so einer Art Kultfigur und Identifikationsfigur für dieses Viertel um den MacArthur Park geworden, was ja nicht so ein ganz unproblematisches Viertel ist mit ganz viel Homelessness und so weiter. Diese Puppe präsentiert inzwischen Mode, taucht auf Community-Events auf, tritt in Musikvideos auf, hat eine riesige Fangemeinde, ein riesiges Instagram-Following Und Kain war so nett, mich zu treffen und hat mir ein bisschen was von seiner Arbeit erzählt. Hier ein Einblick.
You know, one of my friends acquired the job in a theater, in a puppet theater, which is the Bob Bacon Marionette Theater. And he got the job to do some drops that go up and down and some sceneries and stuff like that.
Like
and
a technician?
Yeah, kind of, yeah. And like that. And they wanted somebody to do the lighting effects, like the lighting guy. Oh, okay. And, you know, he asked me, hey, you want to work in a theater? In my mind, I thought it was going to be like a movie theater. You know, I was like, oh, I'm going to be looking at free movies. I'm going to go in there and you look just all these movies for free, you know, and see the stuff. But I walked in this puppet theater and I seen like an hour show. They had over 100 puppets. It was like around Halloween. So I seen like a Halloween theme show. And it was mind blowing to me, you know, because I never seen a puppet show before. Actually, a marionette. I never seen marionettes before. And it was my first experience. It just kind of caught my eye and it kind of just grabbed me, you know, didn't let me go because, you know, it kind of made me want to learn, trying to see what was going on with the theater, you know. Of course, you know, Bob Baker hired me. I spent like 5 years just doing the lighting effects.
Okay.
So I was doing the lighting effects for these shows that we're doing. And me as a lighting technician or lighting guy that I was doing, I would have to see what everybody was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So if a puppet would be on stage, I would have to see how far the puppet would go forward or how much it would go backwards. I would have to learn the song to see how the puppet is moving. And depending on the mood, depending on the song, I will be changing the lighting effects. Mm-hmm. Like if it's snowing, I will put blues and white. If it was a desert, I will put yellows and reds and kind of mimicking the mood and what the atmosphere was. And I spent 5 years just doing all that.
So you didn't grow up in a household or in a family where you went into theater or
no,
where you know what it was?
Nothing. You know, I grew up in the streets. In the streets, you don't hardly find things like that. And in Tijuana, where I'm from, Mexico, you know, it was just mostly soccer on the streets, you know, playing tag. There was not really that much theatrical theaters over there that I know of. Nothing puppetry related. Maybe drawing, you know, that's like an art form and things like that. Drawing and painting and stuff like that. But nothing puppetry world. Nothing puppet related.
Mm-hmm.
I just got here to United States, to Los Angeles, and Bob Baker Marionette Theater introduced me to a whole new world that I didn't even know existed. Because before that, I didn't even seen the movie Pinocchio before, you know, like, because that's, of course, a big famous puppet kind of theme stuff. And I never seen that one before I came to the theater. So, you know, I got to experience the puppetry world, the marionettes and stuff like that. And I just kind of stayed there, you know. It was a job, of course, you know, and I was, you know, fresh from Mexico. And, you know, I was not going to look for another job because I already had one fresh out of high school.
Yeah.
And I just kept it, you know, 5 years turning to 10, 10 turning to 15. And that's when I kind of started kind of more into like trying to learn more of it, you know, because at the beginning it was just a job. You know, it was for 9 to 5. I would go in and out, and I would, of course, do the puppet shows because that was a job. You know, that's what they acquired me to do. But as far as I mean, like, oh, I'm going to go do my job, like, I didn't really fall in love with it the beginning years.
Okay. How did you transition? How did you get the idea to you want to be a puppeteer yourself, maybe?
Well, like I said, I didn't, like, it took me, like, maybe 10 years, man.
Mm-hmm.
10 years already in the form, like, because I was already working there. Bob Baker paid me to be there to help him whatever he needed and things like that. And, you know, I was still kind of more like in a gangster style kind of living, you know, like I would be on the street causing trouble, getting into fights, you know, stealing and doing all that crazy stuff. But when I would come into the Bob Baker world, it was like a whole different, like, vision and fantasy, you know, you could say. And it was an amazing place to be, and, you know, that's why I kept it, you know. It kept me away from a lot of trouble, because, of course, MacArthur Park is not best known for the best place to be living, you know.
Yeah.
It has a lot of really bad reputation, but, you know, it's still there, you know. It's still my home, and as far as fell in love with the puppetry, it was kind of tough, you know, because I was kind of like the troublemaker, like the outsider from that little group that was there, because it was like 10 puppeteers there, you know. I was just one of them, you know. There was other puppeteers that went to puppetry school. They went to, like, you know, they got degrees in puppetry. And I just came from the streets, you know. And, you know, I was never really there in the Christmas parties. I was never really there in their picture group kind of pictures and stuff like that. And, you know, even though I spent, like, 15 years with Bob Baker working, I actually never took a picture with him. I was never, like, in that type of, like, oh, you know, let me take a picture. Like, it was just, you know, it was my boss, you know. That was as far as I kind of remember. And, of course, he kind of planted the seed of puppetry into me. And that's what I'm still doing right now, which is pretty lovely because without him being in my life, I don't know where I'll be. Probably in jail, probably even dead, probably, and back in Mexico. Because, you know, of course, you know, my status, immigration is a little difficult. But, you know, I've been doing good, man. I'm flying straight, you know. I'm just kind of riding my own wave in whatever comes my way. I'm trying to do, you know, and I'm out there kind of like, hey, you know, things like that. People love what I do, and they appreciate something different, you know, because not a lot of people seen a marionette before, you know. I created El Triste, which mm-hmm. is one of my first marionettes that one of my friends helped me create with me. And I created him more as an example to show people what a marionette looks like, and eventually bring people into the Babek Marionette Theater and see way bigger things, and, you know, like a real puppet show, you know, because he's pretty small compared to the other puppets. Mm-hmm. He doesn't talk. He doesn't blink. you know, it's just the expression that he has, and you know,
doesn't talk.
No, he doesn't talk. No. He's just practically, it was a doll that I broke apart.
Okay.
And I added, of course, my friend added like some features to look more like me, because that's kind of like my slick back, more yeah. my facial. So I kind of made him look like me. And I labeled him El Triste, the saddest puppet in Los Angeles, you know. Mm-hmm. El Triste, the sad one, that's what translates the sad one. And, you know, I feel like sadness is like a really strong feeling, because, you know, Bob Baker actually never saw my first puppet, because he passed away in 2014. He was 93 when he passed away, 93 years old, and he was doing puppets since he was 8. So like 80 plus years of doing what you love is just amazing. And, you know, just to be able to be in that journey and be in that conversation with him and his name and all that, I'm just privileged, man, because, you know, I feel like I'm living somebody else's dream, you know, because I'm not supposed to be over here, you know.
Yeah. But what is the business?
The business is, you know what, like, I built them more as an example to show people what a marionette looks like, right? So mm-hmm. I didn't have no clue what my puppet was going to do or what he's going to become. So little by little, people were requesting him to be in music videos. Little by little, people wanted him to be model, like actor, doing like little scenes and things like that. Oh, trust me, like this guy's practically everything that I cannot be. Yeah, because, you know, like, I don't consider myself an actor or a model. He's the one that kind of helped me with that, because sometimes they hire him, but I have to be there with him, you know. So it's like we kind of both get hired to do certain things in the same way that, like, I never think to do
also
stuff.
Parties, birthdays.
Oh yeah, I've done so many quinceañeras, birthday parties, and the thing about that people think that I do performances, and I actually don't perform anymore.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask. Like, how does the appearance of Tristan look like?
I mean, you know, people treat him like as a celebrity. You know, he's like a big supposedly Los Angeles icon that people love to see. You know, and when it comes to parties, I practically go into the party to be a part of the family too. If people are dancing, I make my puppets dance. If people are taking pictures, I take pictures with them. If people are hitting the piñata, then doing the jumper thing. Like, I make my puppets act like real people.
Ah, okay. So he's a guest then.
Yeah, he acts like a guest.
He's not the celebrity guest. He's just like, he behaves like one of the guests.
Yeah, exactly that.
Nice. Interesting.
And, you know, I do sing like maybe 2 songs, but that's like 5-10 minutes. It's not like a whole 2-3 hour thing, you know. Of course, the most famous song, I'm Your Puppet, that's like a really good oldies, and he's really famous for this one song called Nobody's Clown. It's like a really famous song that this group called Los Yesterdays created. It's about this one clown that his girlfriend left him for another guy. So it's like about this sad clown, and practically the whole song, if you listen to it and you see the video, it's practically about this guy and his girlfriend and this whole little thing going on. So it's pretty amazing how this song kind of blew up all over the world.
Yeah.
So everybody knows him because of that one song. And it's amazing because
he's in the music video.
Yeah, yeah. He's probably done maybe like 10 or 15 music videos right now.
Vom Puppenspiel nun in einen ganz anderen Bereich, und zwar in den Bereich des Drag. Das hat in L.A., besonders in West Hollywood, natürlich eine total lange Tradition, gipfelt vielleicht in so etwas wie so dem Erfolg von RuPaul's Drag Race, das ja auch in L.A. gedreht wird. Kleine Side Note, in der Zeit meines Stipendiums im Thomas Mann Haus hatte ich auch die Gelegenheit, zu Dreharbeiten von RuPaul's Drag Race zu gehen. Und zwar wurde gerade die Season 11 von All Stars gedreht. Und ich habe einen Tag dort verbracht, musste allerdings ein Non-Disclosure Agreement unterschreiben und darf darüber nicht sprechen. Sobald diese Episode ausgestrahlt wurde, werde ich natürlich im Rahmen einer der dann erscheinenden Etablissement-Episoden mal ein bisschen aus dem Nähkästchen plaudern, wie das so war. Zurück zum Drag in L.A. Ich habe mir natürlich einige Clubs in West Hollywood angeschaut, wo zum Teil auch diese Drag Race Queens Hosts sind oder Abende moderieren, Abende gestalten. Habe dann aber zum Interview Paige Person getroffen, die sich so zwischen dem Ernsten und dem Unterhaltenden hin und her bewegt. Und zwar hat sie als Malerin, bildende Künstlerin angefangen, sich dann als trans geoutet und sich in diesem Moment in der Kunstwelt nicht mehr repräsentiert oder unwohl gefühlt, nicht willkommen gefühlt. Und hat eine neue Heimat im Drag-Bereich, im Nachtleben von L.A. gefunden, ihre Kunstpraxis auf eine Art dorthin verlegt und versucht quasi bildende Kunst in den Drag-Bereich zu bringen und umgekehrt dann auch wieder Drag zurück in den bildenden Kunstbereich, in dem sie jetzt doch auch wieder so langsam tätig wird. Hier also Paige Person.
So my history as an artist is I had a whole career as a primarily visual artist prior to coming out as trans, which came to an abrupt end. Like 15 years ago, I started coming out as trans and all of my gallery relationships ended. All of my relationships with curators and collectors ended. And I was getting, people were literally trying to block my work from being shown because to protect its value.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And through a series of events, I ended up finding community in queer nightlife and specifically in the drag scene. And what was really surprising to me about that community was here was a group of people from very diverse socioeconomic backgrounds who were all interested in art. They had never had access to art education, but they were interested in creativity and they wanted to see envelopes being pushed. They wanted to see something they hadn't seen before. They were interested in making political statements through creative acts. And I thought, you know, this world has always felt separated from the art world to me in this hierarchy, right? Mm-hmm. And having been cast out of the sort of gatekeeping, institutionalized art world, I thought, honestly, I'm kind of more on the side of this community. This community has accepted me without question and encouraged me to be creative in any way that I saw fit.
Yeah.
Whereas the art world, soon as I came out as trans, now obviously it's a different world and they want to perform, they want to check diversity boxes and give the appearance that they support trans people.
Yeah.
15 years ago, that was definitely not the case. So I kind of took the challenge to myself to, what if I made art in this world, right? And I found sometimes I would do things that were too artsy.
Ah, okay.
And would maybe not be entertaining enough. Or I would do things that felt just like entertainment. But I did find some space where I would feel like, hey, I'm actually making art in a context that's not approved by the institutional art world, but feels like forging new creative territory for me as an artist.
Yeah.
The whole time, I feel like a lot of artists feel this way, that they can't help being artists, they can't help having creative urges,
yeah,
right? And it's the context in which you make that work.
Yeah, but did drag always play a role in your work, even before coming out as trans or before leaving the art?
Only secretly.
Why only secretly? That would interest me. Like, was it like some kind of guilt feeling? Thing? Like
not guilty pleasure. It was fear of being cast out.
Ah, okay. So you wouldn't incorporate elements of that into your work?
Well, so I was making paintings of feminine bodies that I didn't let anyone know were based on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing sort of secret drag performances and photographing them and making paintings from them and not ever telling anyone. So these sort of rich cishet white men were buying my art, thinking it was just conventionally attractive cis women posing. And then I started coming out and I started telling people this, and immediately the people with money said, we're not.
Ah, that's interesting. So
So your paintings also had like some kind of hidden element of drag
mm-hmm.
in them.
Exactly.
Without anyone knowing.
Exactly.
Oh, wow. That's subversive in a way.
Well, it felt that way. And now looking back, I can see that there's much more power in owning what you're doing and being more open about it.
Yeah.
But there was no art. There was no art world support for that. 15 years ago.
I see.
But then I found that in the drag community. And over the last several years, especially after the COVID lockdown changed things a lot for me because there was no longer an audience. So I started focusing more on painting again than performing for a live audience because there was no live audience. And in that time, I sort of reflected, well, I've spent an equal amount of years in my life doing drag as painting. And they both feel pretty similar to me. They're both coming from the same place in my, you know, as a creative person, I don't know where this stuff comes from. Like just one minute I have a picture in my mind and I want to realize it in the world.
Yeah.
So I sort of took the challenge in 2020 to exist sort of equally in both worlds. And I would say, you know, I want to make drag in art spaces and art in drag spaces.
Yeah.
Because those distinctions, I didn't see who those distinctions were benefiting other than those of the rich art collectors that wanted to maintain value on things that weren't theirs.
I see. Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit like how you got in contact with the drag scene or how you learned?
I just found it.
Okay.
I found it in my neighborhood drag bar. My neighborhood bar had like one drag night.
Which bar was that?
The Offbeat has a show called Exposure Drag that offers people, they sort of specialize in booking first-time performers. And I just started going to that as a regular. They sort of could tell that I wanted to perform and asked me to perform on the same night I was going to ask them anyway.
Okay.
So I just started performing and it just felt so natural to me. And like I said, it was something I was already doing sort of in secret
mm-hmm.
on my own. So it was really liberating for me to be able to be more seen fully as the artist that I was.
What did you learn in the drag community or from the drag community for your art? If you learned something.
I feel like an art audience wants to intellectualize things in a way that oftentimes I think that they don't even completely understand, but it feels good to be using words. They love to say the name of a philosopher in a statement, even though they haven't read or understood the work of that philosopher.
Yes.
What I learned from the drag community was that actually being myself and speaking openly about my lived experience was more valuable than me reflecting something I had lived in a book, that I had read in a book.
Wenn man sich in L.A. gerade für Bühnen interessiert, egal ob es jetzt Strip, Zauberei, dazu muss ich sagen, ich habe in L.A. auch das Magic Castle besucht, die Vereinigung der Zauberer, davon muss ich auch irgendwann nochmal berichten, Iconic. Ob man sich aber für Strip interessiert, für Drag, für Musical, für klassisches Theater, was auch immer, man kommt am New Theater Hollywood gerade nicht vorbei. Und zwar ist das ein ganz kleines Theater, das von zwei bildenden Künstlern gegründet wurde, vor knapp 2 Jahren. Und zwar von Carla Henkel, die auch Bücher schreibt, und Max Pittigoff. Die beiden haben schon in Berlin, wo sie ziemlich lange Zeit verbracht haben, einige Bars/Theater geleitet und sorgen im Moment gerade für Furore mit diesem New Theater in Hollywood. Das ist natürlich eine total haarsträubende Idee, in Hollywood ein Theater zu gründen, was ja nun eine absolute Filmstadt ist. Und über ihren Weg dahin und auch über ihre Erfahrungen ein wenig in Berlin habe ich mit den beiden gesprochen. Also hier sind Carla Henkel und Max Pittigoff.
It's so interesting to me that you are interested in theater because usually everybody who comes from the visual arts hates theater.
It was 2012. We were like immersed in this kind of post-internet art scene that was so not about performance.
Yes.
You know, it was about like creating the object and thinking about the internet. And it was so dematerialized and then materialized in a way that was so outside of kind of the idea of theater.
Yeah.
But we were interested in collaboration and how theater presents this kind of version of collaboration that's a hierarchy that's really easy to enter. And I think we had also seen all of these kind of egos of artists, and we were like, theater is a place where the ego can be left aside and everyone has a role.
Yeah, and I think the art world also turned us off, and like we were doing performances sometimes in galleries and it's like no one knows where to sit, no one knows how to behave, no one knows anything. It's like exhausting and amorphous, and like the focus is never on the thing itself, and theater is so like old and ancient, and it's a contract that like everyone understands, and there's a release in that. Like people That's love right. buying a ticket to a show and sitting down. You know, it's like
easiest that
it's so easy, you yeah. know, and it's like, it's not like with art where it's like, did you get it? Or you didn't even like look at the art because you were busy. Like it's a different thing. And I think Max and I also were really interested in German theater as a kind of like political structure that like everyone goes to the theater. It's like this sort of, you know, like air, water theater. Like it's this sort of bread and butter of culture there. And so I think there was also this like joy in taking this form that was so hierarchical and then asking all these people who were used to kind of egotistical black, white boxes and asking them to come into a sort of, I mean, it wasn't a black box, but it was a sort
of. We painted New Theater gray.
Yeah.
We were like, it's somewhere between a black box and a white.
White cube.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there was definitely some like young humor in it, but I think there was like also some real sentimentality. Like we want, like Max and I have always had a very earnest practice, and there's moments in time when that works and there's moments in time when it doesn't. And like we can't change. I think we're at a moment right now when irony is really like hard to deal with because things are so horrible. And I think theater in this way is so direct, so forward, so honest. The contract's so clear. There's an earnesty to it. And I think it is important and like vital in a way that like, it's not that I'm saying that art's not, but I'm saying like performance art has not been granted the space that theater has. And I think we love the structure of the space. Mm. And so we borrowed the structure. And then in that process, we became huge theater dorks.
I mean, we had moved to Berlin and started going to see plays at the Volksbühne without knowing much German.
So we would sit in these like 6-hour long plays. Like it was like crazy. And I think kind of also that reforms your brain in terms of watching things when you're like not able to follow, but you're following and you're moved. And it's like, then it's like, you're like, it's just, I think we were quite transformed by theater at the Volksbühne. And then when we started our theater, everyone was sort of angry at us in the theater world because we had called it New Theater. And they were like, are you calling us old theater? And we were like, we just meant it was new to us.
But how did you decide to come to LA then? Or what brought the decision?
Because I got like really dumped, like brutally dumped by a girl.
Okay.
We were like going to get married. Like now that I look back on that, I was like, I was right to leave. Then the building got sold. So the bar was not ours to kind of pass on. Which is like a sad but apt wrap up of that era.
Very Berlin. Yes, it's like Berlin in a nutshell.
In 2022.
Yeah, all of a sudden there's all these like men in suits kind of roaming around the building with clipboards, and you know it's done. And so that was the exit. So we knew it was over kind of for us there. I got dumped. Your husband was here.
Yeah.
So, or in America.
Yeah, we both had things that were pulling us.
Yeah.
Towards America, even though we had never thought we would move back there.
Because I mean, to open a theater in LA sounds kind of insane.
We had this kind of joke about opening a theater here to different people who lived here. And it like kind of slowly started to not become a joke anymore. It became like a plan, and people were getting really excited about it also. And there was kind of this energy that was at our backs, this wind that was at our backs, kind of telling us like it would actually work to open a theater. And there are people who want to
Yeah, and we also knew we wanted to make another film, and we had originally wanted the next film we made to be about someone running a theater, but we had decided that maybe we didn't have to run the theater this time, that maybe we could just do it in fiction, like normal filmmakers.
Okay.
And then we were shooting something else, and we saw a sign on Santa Monica Boulevard outside this theater that said Theater for Rent, and we called, and we got to see it the next day, and I sort of gabbed with the landlord while Max brought the 16mm camera and filmed in it. And then like we both kind of realized it was this perfect space. And also there was a decision that if we didn't take it, it would be turned into a hair salon, mm-hmm. which just felt like sacrilege because it's this sort of...
I mean, it came with kind of the entire setup of a theater, yeah. you know, these red velvet seats, these chandeliers, the lighting rigs. Ed Harris, like, rented that theater in the 80s, coming from San Francisco, like, from the San Francisco theater world,
yeah.
in order to, like, make it big.
Yeah. Sam Shepard
wrote a play for him to perform there, and it worked.
And the guy said he was a celebrity by the end of the week.
That is so L.A.
I know.
Yeah, there's, like, this yearning for transformation here, which, like, is very un-German.
Yes.
You know, it's like... So I think like the material of what we're working with in running a theater here versus in Berlin is very different. You know,
it's, how would you describe it? Like as a feel? How does it feel here?
Like people are more excited to make theater here because it's like seems outrageous. Like it seems so outside of what normally happens.
Here in
LA, yet everyone, it's a town full of performers. It's a town full of makeup artists. It's a town full of like wig makers.
And writers who don't do theater, and
editors and directors. And so it's like theater is this kind of weird bastard step thing that's just like not... It's like the closet or something. I don't know. That there's something embarrassing about it. And I think in New York, it's also like as an actor, that's where you go to rehab your career. If something's gone wrong,
it's where you learn. Your craft.
Exactly.
It's where the serious
theater
happens. Yeah. yeah. And so here it's just something at some other world. And I think because there's no expectations there, it means like if you come in with like a real like open-hearted seriousness, which I would say we have, people are like, oh, yeah, let's go. Like, I have this skill. I have this ability. I want to figure out how to make it work in a certain way. But there is this like shimmer or desire for transformation. And that is what is super different than Berlin. Like, I think everyone kind of wants a producer to see their show and have it turned into a TV show.
Yeah.
Like at some point in every play other than Asher's, you know, someone's like turned to us and been like, but don't you think this should be a movie? Or don't you think that, you know, and you're like, whoa, like, and that never happens in German theater.
Zum Schluss möchte ich noch einmal Charles Busch den roten Teppich ausrollen. Charles Busch hat so ein eigenes Genre geschaffen von so melodramatischen Dragstücken, die er sich selber auf den Leib geschrieben hat, umgeben von einem völlig verrückten Ensemble, das er so um sich geschart hatte im Laufe der Zeit. Charles Busch war selber sehr beeinflusst von den Arbeiten von Charles Ludlam damals und ist heute aber ziemlich deutlich auch ein Vorbild für so Arbeiten von Cole Escola wie O'Mary gerade am Broadway. Am Ende deutet er das auch so ein bisschen an, dass er da, glaube ich, auf eine Art auch Pate stand, so in diesem Größenwahn, sich selber so eine Show auf den Leib zu schneidern. Und Charles ist berühmt geworden Anfang der 80er mit einem Stück Vampire Lesbians of Sodom, das erst im East Village gespielt wurde, im tiefsten East Village in der Limbo Lounge und das später auch an den Off-Broadway transferiert wurde, wo es ziemlich lange und ziemlich erfolgreich lief. Das ist das Stück, mit dem er sich so seinen Namen gemacht hat. Und immer hat er quasi die glamouröse Hauptrolle gespielt. Er sagte immer so, er wollte halt in seinem Leben nichts anderes als Sarah Bernhardt sein. Und diesen Traum hat er sich in seinen Stücken immer wieder erfüllt. Und das ist so ein bisschen auch so dieses Subjektive und dieses Persönliche, wo ich denke, ach, das ist schon schön und das bringt auch sehr skurrile, tolle, interessante Theaterarbeiten hervor. Und deswegen möchte ich mit Charles enden. Hier ist Charles, wie er von der Entstehung dieses Stücks berichtet, dass ein Durchbruch war. Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. Damit endet unsere Revue, unser Rückblick auf die Zeit des Etablissements in den USA. Bis demnächst.
I had met a woman, a performer at the Renaissance Fair, who was this very exotic woman from Pakistan named Bina Sharif, and she was a performance artist. She was hired at the Renaissance Fair to play like a gypsy, and she was just roaming around, you know, and harassing people. We stayed friends after the summer, and she said she was doing a performance piece way down, way far in East Village, beyond East Village to Alphabet City, it's called, because when you go all the way east, the avenues are just called Avenue A, Avenue B, Avenue C.
Okay.
And in 1984, I was so fascinated by this venue. It was called the Limbo Lounge. It was a little store, narrow storefront, and it was an art gallery, but they also used it as a performance space. There was no stage or anything. It was just, I felt like I was in Berlin in 1930. It was so like that. And Vina's act, she was, you know, with all this glitter in her hair, and she was just reciting the names of designer perfumes. It was a very exotic way. And the crowd was sort of gay, sort of punk, sort of goth, you know. And as soon as Vina finished her last word, I said, Ken, we've got to do a show here somehow. And before he could say yes or no, I was running around trying to find who's the owner? Who's the owner? And it was this young guy who called himself Michael Limbo, have his head shaved and got out this big calendar, you know, and said, well, you can do Friday and Saturday nights 6 weeks from now. I thought, I'll take it. And I said, Ken, we're doing a play. And he said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I don't want to do my solo shows all dressed in black and just me, you know, being serious. We've got to do something that's very decadent and fitting this room. And, you know, I really wanted to, you know, I missed working with other people, and we needed 45 minutes of dialogue, something to do. So just what could we do for no money at all? No budget. I said, but I want to play female character. I want to be this, you know, Sarah Bernhardt. And I had read Interview with the Vampire, those first couple books. And I thought that was very romantic. So I thought, well, I could be this ageless vampire. So with some, I need a rival, another vampire. So I just, you know, wrote this piece really, really fast. I mean, like a couple hours. I just needed dialogue and needed a title. And my best friend from college, who is now at a big job as an advertising executive, I described the story to him, and he just said, why don't you call it? He was trying to think of like an exploitation novel type title. Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. I said, that's fine. That'll do. It didn't matter. You know, it was for two nights. And then I needed to cast it. And for my rival, I thought, oh, Bina should do it. You know, she's the star, you know, they know her.
Yeah.
So even though it was very hard understanding anything she said with her Pakistani accent, she couldn't say pronounce the letter V. It was like Wampir, but whatever. So we rehearsed it. We read through it in my living room. And the next day she called up, said that her mother in Pakistan had a stroke and she had to fly immediately and couldn't do the play. So I called up. I knew this marvelous actress who worked with Charles Ludlam, who was 15 years older than me, and called herself Lola Paschalinski. She'd won an Obie Award and all this.
What a name.
And she had always been nice to me, encouraging. Yeah. She was nice to me. So I called her and she said, okay. And anyway, so we just rehearsed it a couple times in my living room, and it's like $35. The costumes we just kind of pieced together from stuff I had. And, you know, we just kind of threw it together and we just had a great time. And it was just really fun. And I want to do it again. And Lola wouldn't do it a second time. She was so far beyond that. She liked actually, you know, getting paid. She liked having a bathroom, you know, stuff like that, you know, you know, like weird shit like that. Yeah. So I needed another vampire, and everybody turned me down. My own sister turned me down. Last one on my list was this blonde girl who, she worked on Wall Street as like a, you know, corporate librarian, but she I'd met her once before, and she had sort of fantasies about being a performance artist, you know. And I saw her try to do it, and it was terrible, but I was just desperate. And, you know, so I called her up. I was sort of hoping she'd say no. And she said, oh, yeah, sure. Well, she came over, and we read through the script, and, oh, she was so bad. And Ken said, Charles, can I just talk to you in the kitchen for a second? And so the kitchen was there. Julie said she overheard the entire conversation. She's terrible. She can't act. She was, it's all we've got, you know? So anyway, so she did it. And her name's Julie Halston. She's
legend.
Yeah. So she had never really acted before, and she was terrible, but she's such a wonderful personality.
Yeah.
And she was always that way. And so when we rehearsed it in my living room with the cast, and who were basically all amateurs, and even they were horrified at how bad she was. And finally, she just stopped the rehearsal. She said, okay, listen, I know I stink, but I'm telling you, you put me in a wig in front of 60 gay men and I glow. And it was sort of true.
It's the truth,
probably. It was the truth. It wasn't like she was good, but she was a big personality. And we all adored her. One time I had seen her try to be a performance artist. You know, she was just trying to talk in this very, you know, nice lady voice. But when she would tell me stories about her mother, and she'd tell these stories, and it was so funny. Or even in just the way she would talk in real life, like in conversation, if she was here right now, it's like she has her own talk show. Like, she'll, you know, Charles, thoughts and reflections about the death of Marvin Gaye. I mean, just like she talks like this, you know, it was so funny. So I started writing it in. So I rewrote Vampire Lesbians to put her what I call her trip, into it. So it's hard for her to play grand, but she can play somebody who's a real kind of tough dame who's trying to put on airs. So I would, you know, I would write lines in for her, like, I have caskets full of precious jewels, but where the fuck can I wear them? You know, it's do the flip.
Yeah.
And that's where I realized, yeah, oh, that's who she is, you know. So we kind of developed this persona for her. Word got out, and people were lined up down the block. It's not very good, you know, but it was the right moment to, you know, AIDS was just start really hitting. And I think the gay community, particularly, suddenly there's a new drag queen who's pretty and, you know, and young and with her friends and putting on something with this crazy title. And
yeah,
I find it a little bit similar to what's going on with O Mary here in New York, that, you know, people were living in such scary times that suddenly here's this very pretty young drag queen who writes her own plays.